Holocaust-denying content online, and a rapper, Kanye West, who has also made anti-Semitic comments. The former president's decision to dine with Nick Fuentes and Kanye West soon after launching his 2024 presidential campaign has already sparked widespread condemnation from Democrats, but Republican lawmakers have been slower to speak out, and most who did so on Monday, 28th of November, stopped short of Mike Pence's call for an apology from Donald Trump. Senator Marco Rubio, a Republican senator from Florida who vied against Donald Trump in the 2016 presidential primary, said he hopes to see the former president condemn Nick Fuentes, because I know Trump's not an anti-Semite. I can tell you that for a fact that Trump is not. But Fuentes is evil, just a nasty, disgusting person. And he's trying to legitimize himself by being around a former, maybe a future president. Other Republicans frowned upon the meeting itself while stopping short of outright condemnation. The Senate GOP's number two leader, John Thune of South Dakota, called the dinner a bad idea on every level and said whomever on Donald Trump's staff advised it should be fired. It's ridiculous that he had that meeting, said Senator Joni Ernst, a Republican senator from Iowa, another member of GOP leadership, and that's all I'm going to say about it. Just crazy. Senator Steve Daines, a Republican senator from Montana, condemned the idea of anti-Semitism generally when asked about the meeting, but went no further. We cannot tolerate anti-Semitism, period, said Senator Daines, who's set to chair Senate Republicans' campaign arm for the 2024 election. Senator Mike Rounds of South Dakota said he wasn't going to condemn anybody, adding that Nick Fuentes is just not somebody that I would have a meeting with. Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri struck a similar note, saying while he wouldn't personally dine with Nick Fuentes, it's a free country and Trump can do whatever he wants. Both Senator Mike Rounds and Senator John Cornyn, a Republican senator from Texas, a close ally of Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, said they didn't know who Nick Fuentes was. I'm really not going to spend any more time worrying about whether or not those two people are meeting with one another, Senator Rounds said. Since his pre-Thanksgiving dinner with Nick Fuentes and Kanye West, Donald Trump also has said he did not know who Nick Fuentes was when the latter, who joined scores of other white nationalists in attending the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, that turned violent, came to dinner at Mar-a-Lago as a guest of Kanye West. The dinner was intended to be Kanye and me only, Trump said in a post on his Truth Social platform, shying away from direct criticism of Nick Fuentes. Before Senate Republicans returned to Washington on Monday evening, one of their own had already tweeted with notably sharp criticism. Senator Bill Cassidy, a Republican senator from Louisiana who voted to convict Donald Trump at his second impeachment trial, sought to put distance between Trump's actions and the Republican Party as a whole. President Trump hosting racist anti-Semites for dinner encourages other racist anti-Semites, Senator Cassidy tweeted. He added, "These attitudes are immoral and should not be entertained. This is not the Republican Party."
Saudi Arabia in the world of politics.
Part 2.
In recent years, Saudi Arabia has been the largest buyer of arms in the world and is making great efforts to continue on this path. At the same time, it is trying to start a coalition of its friends, especially the Arab countries, against Iran.
Talk is cheap. Let's look at the actions. Saudis helped Saddam Hussein for 8 years. Saudis helped Al-Qaeda. Saudis created Daesh. Saudis created al-Nusra. So they started this sectarian message, not us.
Nonsense. The Iranians are the ones who are exporting terrorism. They're the ones who are stoking the fires of sectarianism. They're the ones who are violating international laws and norms and acceptable behavior. And they are the ones who have been on an aggressive path since 1979.
Despite the fact that the United States and almost every other powerful nation supports Saudi Arabia actively and tries to undermine us actively, we are still the most influential power in the Middle East. That should tell you something. That should tell you that we have made the right choices and they've made the wrong choices.
The end of World War I was an era of reform in the world of politics. It was no longer like the days before the war, and the following years were the beginning of a new era for geographical maps. New rulers, one after another, could find their place in the world of politics. In Iran, it was Reza Shah's turn. A few years later, on the anniversary of Reza Shah's reign, Saudi King Abdulaziz bin Saud sent him a congratulatory message. In response, on July 1st of 1928, Habibullah Hoveyda was sent to Hejaz as Iran's representative so that Iran could officially begin its ties with the Saudi dynasty. During the years after these negotiations, the most important issue between the two countries was performing the Hajj and organizing the sending of Iranian pilgrims to Hejaz. It continued until 1944, when a young man named Abu Talib Yazdi and his wife decided to travel to Saudi Arabia to perform Hajj. During the Tawaf, this 22-year-old man got sick in the heat of the sun and vomited. Urged by some pilgrims, Saudi officers accused him of vomiting deliberately. Abu Talib was arrested and the judge sentenced him with beheading. The sentence was carried out in public. As the bitter news of Yazdi's beheading reached Iran, a wave of protest began in the country. On January the 18th of 1944, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Iran issued a statement and sent a letter to Saudi Arabia condemning this act. In the following days, many articles condemning this act and asking the government to protest Saudi Arabia were published in newspapers. Iran did not find the Saudi government's response to the incident convincing and sent another letter of protest to Saudi Arabia on February the 7th. The lack of relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia continued in the next 5 years until King Abdulaziz sent a letter to Iranian King Mohammad Reza Pahlavi on the subject of cooperation of Islamic nations. In the letter, he also expressed his desire to establish relations between the two countries. Following these letters and with the sending of ambassadors, political relations resumed in 1948 and the issue of Hajj was on the agenda. The Saudi embassy in Tehran announced that it would do its utmost to ensure the security of Iranian pilgrims. In 1958, General Abdul Karim Qasim staged a coup in Iraq. It resulted in overthrowing the monarchy and establishing a republic in the country, a coup that worried both the monarchies of Iran and Saudi Arabia. Qasem was the first head of government in Iraq who claimed that the two Iranian cities of Khorramshahr and Abadan belonged to Iraq. His government also had a clear interest in the Soviet Union. These positions were good reasons for Iran and Saudi Arabia to become closer to one another and become enemies of Iraq. In 1964, King Saud, the second king of Saudi Arabia, died at the age of 67, and his crown prince, King Faisal, came to power. The new king of Saudi Arabia traveled to Iran on his first foreign trip in 1964. Following this visit, the Iran-Saudi Arabia Friendship Association was founded under the chairmanship of the then Prime Minister of Iran, Amir Abbas Hoveida, and bilateral relations expanded from the political and economic spheres to scientific and cultural issues. A few years later, in 1973, Saudi students received scholarships in some fields, including law and medicine in Iran, as Tehran signed a contract to establish a medical college in Riyadh. Oil has always played a decisive role in Iran-Saudi Arabia relations. But one of the most important turning points in this story is the Yom Kippur War between Egypt and Israel in 1973, which led to an oil shock back then. Through Saudi Arabia, the U.S. tried to force Iran to reduce oil prices, and in this regard, contacts and meetings were held between Iran and Saudi Arabia, but neither of them decreased oil prices. In contrast, to satisfy the Americans, Saudi Arabia increased its oil production from 8.3 to 10 million barrels per day. The increase in production, which eventually led to a drop in oil prices, made the Iranian king criticize Saudi Arabia. King Faisal was assassinated by one of the Saudi princes on April the 1st of 1975. This worried all the allies of the Saudi family, especially the King of Iran. Almost a month later, in May of 1975, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi visited the new king of Saudi Arabia, King Khalid, to indicate the relations with that country were important to him. But no one knew that it was the last visit of the Pahlavi king to Saudi Arabia, and the next victim of the world of politics would be him. The Islamic Revolution in Iran changed all equations in the region, and Iran's relationship with Saudi Arabia was an important part of this transformation. Now, there was no sign of a two-columns coalition between Iran and Saudi Arabia in the region, and whatever used to be a matter of closeness between the two countries became a factor of distance.
The people were in a frenzy to catch just a glimpse of the man they revere like a god. And clambered and ran to see and be near him for 15 miles, and no more than a tiny fraction of the multitude succeeded.
The initial reaction of the Saudi officials to the victory of the Islamic Revolution can be called a conservative one. King Khalid, in his first reaction, called the establishment of an Islamic government in Iran a prelude to greater rapprochement and understanding between the two countries. 3 months after the victory of the revolution in April of 1979, a Saudi delegation traveled to Iran. In a meeting with Iran's Imam Khomeini, the leader emphasized the role of Islam in the victory of Muslims, emphasized Islamic unity, reminded of the danger of Israel, and expressed hope that the Saudis' behavior towards Iranian pilgrims would improve. On November the 21st of 1979, an event took place in Mecca that shocked the Islamic world. While the Imam of Masjid al-Haram was preparing for the morning congressional prayer, a group led by Juhayman al-Otaibi entered the Masjid al-Haram and killed several officers. The rebels were members of the Salafist community and were staunch opponents of the Saudi monarchy. After the occupation of Masjid al-Haram, the New York Times was just one of American media outlets which linked the occupiers to Iran. But the next day, Interior Minister Prince Nayef issued a statement stressing the reports that Iran is involved in this matter are completely false and baseless. Finally, after 2 weeks of fighting, with the help of French forces sent to Saudi Arabia, the occupiers of Masjid al-Haram were arrested and 62 members of the group were executed, along with Juhayman. Simultaneously with the occupation of Masjid al-Haram, an unforeseen event in the eastern region of Saudi Arabia made the Saudi rulers angry with Iran. Shias in this area marched on the day of Ashura, demanding their civil rights while they were holding pictures of Imam Khomeini. The Saudi rulers, who were still involved in the occupation of Masjid al-Haram, reacted harshly to the incident, which resulted in 24 deaths on the day of Ashura in 1979. In an interview in January of 1980, the new U.S. President Ronald Reagan stated, "We will not allow Saudi Arabia to become another Iran and fall into the hands of those who want to cut off the vital flow of oil to the West." The liberation of the Iranian city of Khorramshahr from Iraqi forces on May 24th of 1982 is an important milestone in the Ba'athist regime's imposed war against Iran. This upset all the equations of Iraq's leader Saddam Hussein and his supporters, including Saudi Arabia. When Iran achieved success in the war, it led to unprecedented Saudi financial aids to Saddam. According to official reports, Saudi Arabia provided more than $60 billion to Saddam during the war, and this kind of support continued until the end of the war. In June of 1985, the Saudi foreign minister visited the Islamic Republic of Iran for the first time. Saud al-Faisal's agenda was to improve the ties between the two countries and to encourage Iran to conduct peace negotiations with Iraq. In the same year, Iranian foreign minister Ali Akbar Velayati also visited Saudi Arabia. It did not bring much development in the relations between the two countries, but reduced the spread of tension. But among the events between the two countries, the Hajj of 1987 is one of the bitterest days in Iran-Saudi Arabia relations. The Saudi security forces' behavior towards Iranian pilgrims dates back to the disavowal of polytheists in Hajj in the post-revolutionary years. It is annoying for the Saudi authorities to hear the slogans "Death to America" and "Death to Israel," particularly because the U.S. is the main ally of the Saudis. During the Hajj of 1987, more than 400 pilgrims were martyred, 323 of whom were Iranians. Of course, this is a statistic announced by Saudi officials. After this massacre, the Saudi official said that the reason for this behavior towards Iranian pilgrims was their decision to capture Masjid al-Haram and move the Kaaba to Qom in Iran. Finally, On April the 26th of 1987, Saudi Arabia severed political ties with Iran. Shortly after the end of the Iraq-Iran war, Arab countries demanded repayment of the money they had given to Saddam during the war, and Kuwait was at the forefront of these creditors. Iraq's Ba'athist regime, which considered itself to be the representative of the Arab world against Iran, refused to repay its debt. Saddam also called for a reduction in oil production by Arab countries so that he could rebuild the ruins of war by raising oil prices, a request that was opposed by Arab countries, especially Kuwait. The continuation of tensions led to Saddam's invasion of Kuwait on August 2nd of 1990, an event that shocked the whole world, especially the Arab friends of the Ba'athist regime. The Iraqi army even crossed Kuwait and entered the Saudi city of Al-Khafji. The continuation of this campaign could seriously endanger the flow of oil from the Persian Gulf.
Five months ago, Saddam Hussein started this cruel war against Kuwait. Tonight, the battle has been joined.
A U.S.-led coalition of 35 countries quickly formed to oust Saddam's army from Kuwait. Arab countries that thought Iran might side with Saddam welcomed Iran's neutrality, which resulted in the resumption of talks to improve relations with Arab countries, especially Saudi Arabia. In the 1990s, a new era of relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia began that was unprecedented in the years following the Iranian Revolution. In a meeting in June of 1991, the new president of Iran, Hashemi Rafsanjani, called Iran and Saudi Arabia two wings of the Islamic world. A few months later, officials from the two sides met at the Islamic Unity Conference, and Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah invited Hashemi Rafsanjani on a pilgrimage. In the winter of 1998, an important event took place in Tehran. The 8th Summit of Islamic Countries began in the Iranian capital on December the 7th with the participation of the vast majority of heads of Islamic countries and high-ranking officials from 55 Muslim nations. The Saudi delegation is attending the conference at the highest level. For the first time since the Iranian Revolution, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia traveled to Iran to meet senior officials of the Islamic Republic. Relations that had begun in the early 1990s reached their highest level that promised different years ahead. A few months later, an agreement was reached between Tehran and Riyadh in the fields of industrial activities, transportation, environment, sports, and tourism. According to the agreement, the travel ban on citizens in eastern Saudi Arabia, who are mostly Shias, was lifted, and Iran held a trade fair there. After that, direct flights were established from Dammam in Saudi Arabia to Tehran and Mashhad in Iran. The ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia were slowly and cautiously improving in the following years. But an event completely changed the relations in the world of politics. On the morning of September the 11th of 2001, several U.S. airliners changed their predetermined routes and targeted some major centers in different U.S. cities. The world was shocked by this operation, which was somehow like a science fiction movie. Shortly after the attacks, the U.S. administration under President George W. Bush announced its official account. 19 members of Al-Qaeda, led by Osama bin Laden, were responsible for planning and carrying out the operation. Interestingly, 15 of the perpetrators of this operation were Saudi nationals. Saudi Arabia was in the spotlight of the world media, and the important question was how these people were able to carry out these attacks. The days that followed September the 11th were difficult ones for the rulers of Saudi Arabia.
Either you are with us, or you are with the terrorists.
The United States formed a large coalition to fight terrorism and immediately attacked Taliban-controlled Afghanistan. Saudi Arabia and Pakistan were among the few countries which had recognized the Taliban in the previous years.
War on terror is not confined strictly to the Al-Qaeda. The war on terror involves Saddam Hussein. Because of the nature of Saddam Hussein, the history of Saddam Hussein, and his willingness to terrorize himself. Saddam Hussein has terrorized his own people. He's terrorized his own neighborhood. He is a danger.
Shortly after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, its war machine shifted to Iraq. With the U.S.-led coalition attack, the Ba'athist regime, controlled by Saddam Hussein, was overthrown, something that had not happened even after the invasion of Kuwait. Now, Saudi Arabia felt that it had lost the game to Iran in two fronts.
This was central Baghdad today, as Saddam Hussein's regime finally lost control.
The statue of Saddam Hussein.
Iran had important enemies on the other side of both its eastern and western borders that had now fallen, and Saudi Arabia was not pleased with this victory and the change of balance of power by the United States.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
For the millions of people incarcerated in the US, freezing temperatures amid failing infrastructure can be deadly. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. The website of Truthout wrote in this regard, in January 2019, people incarcerated in the Metropolitan Detention Center, a federal jail in Brooklyn, pounded on the windows pleading for help when the facility's heat and electricity went out for a week, leaving more than 1,600 incarcerated people shivering in their dark cells. That same year, people incarcerated in Montana State Prison and their relatives alerted the Montana American Civil Liberties Union that heat wasn't functioning in some parts of the facility. There are guys that are freezing all night long, praying for daylight so they can get access to some warmth, one family member told KPAX, adding, "And I don't care what you did. If you're incarcerated, you've got the right to be treated like a human." In a lawsuit, women incarcerated in Wyoming said, among many other complaints, that when the prison's heating system failed in December 2017, they suffered in the cold for at least a week and were ordered to move their mattresses close together in common areas to stay warmer at night. One woman compared the situation to cattle huddling together outside for warmth. Tracy Meadows wrote of his incarceration in a Tennessee prison in an essay for the Marshall Project, saying, "I spent my time at Mason wrapped in a blanket. Most everyone stayed covered in their blankets, which weren't much heftier than a sheet, but were the only means of staying warm allowed a prisoner. Reading, playing games, eating, watching TV, all done hunched in blankets. Guards wore coats. Prisoners wore blankets. Guards were warm. Prisoners were cold." Dangerously cold temperatures can also plague people incarcerated in U.S. southern states, which are often less prepared to respond to the cold. In 2018, the Texas Inmate Families Association gathered information from families around the state determining that at least 30 Texas prisons had heating issues during a cold snap that year. Subsequent winter storms in Texas have led to terrifying and unsanitary conditions in prisons and jails. In some cases, people report cold temperatures being used for retaliation and punishment. In an ongoing lawsuit over conditions at David Wade Correctional Center in Louisiana, 11 incarcerated people said that correctional staff intentionally left windows open in the winter of 2017 and 2018, including on a night when temperatures reached a low of 14 degrees Fahrenheit. The complaint said, "The use of extreme cold to punish behavior on the tire is not a single isolated incident and occurs so frequently that prisoners have a word for it, bluesing or getting bluesed." People incarcerated in Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, detention facilities have made similar claims of retaliation, including in facilities that hold children. Last year, Ubaldo Ocha Lopez, a father incarcerated in a Texas ICE processing center, told an advocate, "The officers are turning on fans to make it colder. If they are hearing complaints like, 'Oh, it's cold in here,' they'll be like, 'It could be worse,' and turn on fans." He said his staff also threw blankets in the garbage as retaliation. Unlike Charles Plasher, who died of hypothermia on the floor of his Menard Suicide Watch cell, people housed in restrictive isolation or on suicide watch can be additionally susceptible to the cold. On suicide watch, people often lose access to blankets, clothes other than a paper gun, and anything else that could potentially be used to self-harm. The cold might also be felt particularly acutely and have additional health risks for more than 10% of people in state prisons aged 55 and older. Yet another at-risk group are those on antipsychotic drugs, some of which cause a decreased ability to self-regulate body temperature, which can lead to hypothermia. Advocates stress that extreme prison temperatures do not exist in a vacuum. Cold weather also introduces other issues, from rodents to a higher risk of catching COVID and other infectious diseases. And unsafe temperatures are related to and exacerbated by problems like over-incarceration and overcrowding, a disregard for human rights behind bars, and a long-standing move toward more punitive isolating housing. It's really important to understand that the modifications that have been made to old prisons have generally made things worse, Mills said. I think in Illinois, older prisons, for example, cells were originally built with open bars on the front. The state has since replaced these with solid doors, which limit airflow and cause radiator heat to bypass lower-level cells as it rises. Most importantly, when they were designed, cells were meant for sleeping, Mills said, adding, people were out of their cells all day long, either at work, forced work sometimes, or at the yard, or just playing cards out in the open area. And pretty much all that has been eliminated, so people are now spending 20 to 23 hours a day in their cell, where they used to spend just 8 hours sleeping. In addition to the detrimental psychological, physical, and neurological effects of being locked down in a cell day after day, this can mean more time spent on an icy tire. When serving a prison sentence, being denied your liberty is the punishment, said Volin Katz, adding, there is no mandate, there is nothing written into the law to require deprivation and isolation. An extreme temperature experience and all of the other really problematic physical conditions of being incarcerated. She said Illinois prison population has significantly decreased in recent years from more than 49,000 people in 2015 to around 29,000 today. Frankly, we can and we should be shutting down the worst prisons that are currently functioning right now, she said, adding, there is an opportunity. Volin Katz noted that beyond violating the basic human dignity of incarcerated people, freezing and other inhumane prison conditions have consequences for all of society. The vast majority, about 97% of people that go into prisons, come back, she said. If we don't give them treatment and programming, if we treat people horribly, if we put them in high-just living conditions, how do we expect them to go forward better than they were before? With incarcerated trauma from really negative experiences that are going to be very difficult to overcome. She continued, what keeps everybody safer, but helps society be more functional, is making sure that when people violate laws, we give them the tools they need to do better, not lock them in cages and treat them horribly. Bazaar.
Following the success of the first industrial park in 1890, more of these parks began mushrooming all over the world. Industrial zones are viewed as an effective way of increasing synergies between industrial activities through sharing resources. Furthermore, they drive commerce and business for greater economic stability among global and domestic participants. These days, industrial parks are key engines for economic growth and financial security. Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the program that analyzes industries, markets, profits, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we are going to explore Iran's industrial parks. We wanted to see how they are established and operated and who the major players are in this field. Plus, we will examine why industrial parks and estates are so important to the national economy. So, let's get started. To become more familiar with industrial parks, we visited one on the outskirts of the capital city of Tehran. It was originally launched roughly 3 decades ago and has since grown into one of the most densely packed industrial zones of the province. Spanning some 260 hectares of land, this establishment is home to hundreds of producers active in several production fields. So how does this establishment work, and what makes industrial parks attractive to businesses? One answer is that these zones offer unique services that support investors and companies. However, one of the most important advantages is the large plots of land fitted with the necessary infrastructure for production and distribution. Each year, thousands of tons of products are produced here. Industrial parks also provide vast amounts of space to store goods, and some have their own airports and ground terminals for cargo distribution. But that's not all. Many industrial parks are also situated in economic zones, which offer numerous benefits to businesses while cutting some of their development costs. Additionally, there are other advantages to operating in industrial zones for manufacturers who are also exporters. These include softer customs regulations and certain tax exemptions, among others. As a result, exports from these areas have also contributed millions of dollars to the national economy. Industrial zones are ideal catalysts for industrialization and economic development. They provide the infrastructure necessary for small and medium-sized enterprises to grow. These parks have emerged as the new super tonic for the unprecedented growth of urban business and commerce. But have you ever wondered how an industrial park is created? It's no easy task. Planning and launching one of these zones is considered an industry of its own. We caught up with a holding company specializing in planning and developing industrial parks in Tehran province. We wanted to see how these establishments are shaped, executed, and launched. It all starts with targeting the appropriate plot of land. This holding purchases the necessary land, which sometimes can cover hundreds of hectares. This entity carries out its activities under the National Small Industries and Industrial Parks Organization. This organization is affiliated with the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade. So, the holding links various industries with government executive branches and helps remove barriers for manufacturing units. Plus, it connects investors to businesses while handling some of the government's bureaucratic processes for national and international investors. One of the main goals of creating these parks is to support local production and increase exports. Doing so will save the country millions on importing similar goods that can be domestically produced. At its core, an industrial park is a portion of a city or land zoned for industrial use rather than residential or commercial needs. These places can be home to a host of industries and might have oil refineries, power plants, ports, and so much more. The parks serve another purpose too. They are also meant to protect the environment, as industrial parks collect factories and other manufacturing facilities in an area outside of town. Moreover, these zones foster technological learning and innovation while creating jobs. Plus, such sites provide intermediary support for institutions while promoting interdisciplinary networks.
Their activities support market expansion and reach by providing services to companies that help businesses stay relevant in the competitive market. For instance, this holding company has sponsored various national and international exhibitions where companies in industrial zones can participate.
They offer dozens of types of services to small and medium-sized businesses both inside industrial parks and outside these zones. It might be interesting to know that nearly every province of Iran has at least one of these holding companies that establishes industrial parks. For example, the holding company for Tehran province has already established numerous estates and sites over the years, but its activities haven't stopped there. As part of its future vision, this holding hopes to expand its activities, and one of its projects is launching more industrial parks focusing on knowledge-based production. Generally speaking, the number of industrial parks has increased by over 270-fold since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Presently, there are over 1,000 industrial parks and zones scattered across the country. Over 830 of this total has been handed over to industrial units. That's all based on figures from the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade. All things considered, Iran's industrial zones have a bright and promising future while offering lucrative investment opportunities with big profits. The construction industry has continuously had a series of revolutions throughout history. Technological advancements have influenced the construction sector too, from durable concrete in ancient structures to smart windows that automatically open and close based on light exposure. Some materials evolved with time, others are new to the industry and address natural disasters while reflecting changing lifestyles and environmental values. Still, other materials are born out of a need to reduce construction costs. In a nutshell, structures and their materials are the building blocks of society and economic expansion. To understand the enormity of the construction industry, we visited the 22nd Annual International Building and Construction Exhibition in Tehran. Because the exhibition was sprawled over nearly 4 hectares of land, one day is not nearly enough for visitors to see the entire expo, so it ran for 3 days. This exhibition is one of the most important events in its industry. We caught up with a few companies at the exhibit to see what they were offering. Our first stop was at a booth held by a company that makes ceramic tiles. They also export their products to numerous countries. Next, we stopped by a company specializing in manufacturing faucets and kitchen and bathroom attachments. It also purchases most of its raw materials from inside the country. Like many we have seen at the event, this company has created many job opportunities directly and indirectly. Plus, it uses the latest machinery to make high-quality products that compete with foreign brands. Now, many might not think twice about it, but Iran's faucet and fixture production have been booming. So we spoke with another company that has been exporting these items for years. Industry participants say this year's Building Expo was much larger than last year's, meaning that Iran's construction industry has expanded in recent years, displaying the country's various existing and emerging capabilities in the field. Statistics show that last year some 900 domestic companies participated in the event. Also, foreign companies were present, offering their goods and services. This year's exhibit hosted hundreds of foreign companies from Germany, Australia, Turkey, China, Spain, Italy, South Korea, and Malaysia, just to name a few. A wealth of products were showcased at the expo, from road and construction equipment to stones, sanitary supplies, heating and cooling systems, lifts and elevators, and so much more. Rarely has any industry offered so much versatility and variety of products as the construction industry. Events like this one offer a platform for the exchange of ideas, examining markets and opportunities for collaboration to create new products needed in the market. Next, we stopped by a display for a company specializing in making various inset kitchen products. We asked them about their goods and approach to challenges posed by the US sanctions. Walking through the exhibit, we ran into a company that makes metal fittings for stairs, windows, and areas that require spatial separations.
All things considered, the construction sector has been significant for the Iranian economy. The sector is divided into two main parts: government infrastructure projects and the housing industry. The construction industry has been thriving due to national and international investment to the extent that it is now one of the largest in the West Asia region.
This sector suffered a lot after the US withdrew from the 2015 deal and reimposed sanctions against Iran. These measures choked construction materials import. As a result, the steady flow of things like metals to Iran was seriously hampered and eventually halted altogether. But despite the bans, this industry continues to grow and is also one of the few that exports services to other countries. Based on the Association of Iranian Exports of Technical and Engineering Services, Iran currently has the potential to export engineering services worth $40 billion annually. The country already exports these services to countries around the Caspian Sea, its bordering neighbors, South and Central America, North Africa, and South Asia. Some construction projects include sewage treatment plants, dams, and energy plants. According to the Ministry of Industry, Mining, and Trade, Iran is self-sufficient in construction material production. Steel, glass, and cement are abundantly produced in the country. Moreover, the surplus of these items is exported to countries worldwide. Government officials say they have plans to expand exports to Iran's trade partners, including China and Russia. For example, the Ministry of Industry, Mine and Trade says it plans to sell upwards of $3 billion worth of construction materials to Russia alone. As a whole, the government views the construction sector as a feasible alternative for generating foreign revenues and diversifying the country's economy away from oil profits.
And now it's time for me to take a quick break and hand it over to my good friend out in the field who has prepared an exciting report for us.
In ancient Iran, felt was already used in the production of numerous kinds of clothing, bed clothes, floor carpets, and different kinds of sacks. In fact, the Iranian world may have been an important center for the development of felt technology. In the modern world today, felt or namat has found its way to industries of all kinds in various forms.
'You just can't imagine how crowded this place is. Whenever I want to talk on the phone, I have to find a sign-up place to be able to talk to you. It's really crazy. God, in today's chaotic society, stress is an issue that many of us suffer from every day. But what matters most is trying to find distress sources and try to find effective solutions. For this reason, today I'm here to tell you that I finally found a startup, a new innovative company that has finally found a solution to this disastrous problem. I won't tell you any further. Let's just go and check it out.
Felt, or so-called namat, is the acoustic solution for rowdy places to absorb and decrease undesirable noises. The aim is to provide sound serenity and to improve physical, mental, and psychological health. Namat Studio's scope of work is based on designing and manufacturing products. Recently, it has also played a significant role in different projects like some innovation centers in Asia and Africa. This company has focused on designing and building acoustic products. Generally in Iran, there is no specific competitor in this field. However, there are some groups in America and Northern Europe that are engaged with felt.
If I want to tell you about a history about how our company established, it goes back to 3 years ago when Diva was chosen to renovate the innovation factory of Iran, that was the biggest one in the time. And the designer tried to make the offices and they tried to design a place that the people be comfortable, have a good place to work. That's why we understand that we have some advantages and disadvantages. One of these disadvantages is about the sound pollution that we had in the this area, that places were noisy and the employees didn't like that. That's why we try to use special materials for control this sound pollution. And we reach the felt material and we try to use this material.
Designing acoustic and movable working stations with the aim of recycling old products and reuse them in different functions. What is worth noticing about this business is the fact that the problem-solution method is based upon three WH questions: why, how, and what. Why is to define the problem, how is the process towards the solution, and what is the final product and prototype. These acoustic solutions were combined with architecture in various parts of the space and played the role in sound insulation and creating a silent space.
All right, now I want to walk you through some of the major products that are made of felt. The first piece we have here is an artwork that is made of wool felt that acts as a sound-absorbing material, not only as an aesthetic material that you can put it in your home place, but also as a sound-absorbing material. There is a phone booth. If I get inside, I can feel the private space and how the atmosphere really changes. It improves the acoustic vibes and reduces the reverberation when I get inside. And this desk divider is actually one of the main products in this company. People and employees put it in their on their desk to divide their own workplace with the person right next to them.
We have three different kind of material that we use on our works that absorb undesirable sounds, which are wool panels, or the other name is felt, and in Persian we say namat, and thermofelt and carpet. And the felt are in two kind of industrial felt and the natural felt. Natural felt is made by wools, and industrial material is made by a process by the battles and pet materials. They have different color patterns and thicknesses. The thicknesses are from 3 millimeter to 50 millimeter. And about the thermofelt, we have this material that we can use for more absorption. It has three kind of material with polyester, jeans, and heavy traffic, and it's very good for absorbing. And the last one is the carpet that is heavy traffic that we use in heavy traffic places such as the offices, and it can be cleaned very easy by the vacuum cleaner.
As I mentioned earlier, this idea was created based on the concept of recreating, recycling, and revitalizing the surrounding substances and generalizing this idea to the upcoming products with different potentials. Such small-scale products are intended to improve the mental and physical health of users. And finally, creating a comfortable, inviting atmosphere.
Just like linear lighting, almost everything here is made of felt. Based on environmental psychology, the linear lighting has been created in a way to provide maximum visual and acoustic comfort in the workplace, especially a co-working space like this. This company, Namad Startup, has been trying to promote sustainability and also take steps towards industrialization. Among all the products here, there were so many things, but I decided to choose this felt laptop case to carry my laptop with me wherever I go. So it's not about the ideas, it's about making the ideas happen. I've been Sarah Dema.
We're almost near the end of our program, but Before we go, let's take a look at some news and trends on industrial parks and other related trades. As the number of industrial parks in the country grows, so does the maintenance cost of these areas. Iran's Small Industries and Industrial Parks Organization, or ISIPO, says over half of these parks are in need of renovation.
The organization says around 60% of the country's industrial parks are over 15 years old and need maintenance and overhauls. Based on official figures, nearly 50,000 industrial units have started their activities in these parks. However, the ISIPO